Hi, I'm Marion McPratt, and my guest today on Piano Jazz is Mercer Ellington, the conductor of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and he also happens to be Duke Ellington's son. Mercer, it's great that you're here to do Piano Jazz with me.
Oh, listen, just fine to see you again after, you know, just being able to visit from time to time through the years.
Not often enough, though.
Yeah, I shouldn't be saying through the years. I mean, it's only been about 5 years, folks.
But, you know, it's interesting, though, that you're here on the 20th anniversary of Duke's death, aren't you?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm glad that we're here. And the thing that's great is the exhibit that's going on.
Well, they have done a tremendous job with the Smithsonian and doing the things to let people know various parts of Ellington's career. I went there to the museum, not only in Washington, D.C., but also here in New York, and I found that there were things about the old man that either you forgot or sometimes it somewhere in the articles written about him by other people, you just never realize it yourself. So there's much learning to be gotten as a result of seeing the exhibit.
Even from you, his son.
That's
amazing.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. We eventually feel that we should have the Duke Ellington story done somewhere. We've been discussing the possibility of a motion picture and all. And the question is, what do you say about Duke Ellington, and how do you present him, or what kind of a handle do you pick him on? I just don't think that there is any kind of a category to put him into. As you know, he hated categories.
Beyond category,
yes.
As he himself would say.
And it's this kind of a thing that will give us more or less the pulse of what people expect and the interest that lies in his career.
You promised to play a tune. You promised to play Sea Jam Blues. Are we going to play it or else?
Yeah, why not?
Or what?
I think it kind of goes like this.
Workshop, a series of workshops in Washington, D.C., and you don't know this, but it had always been my dream that I would do something like this and that I would be able to show these kids some Duke Ellington music and I would be able to get him down there to perform something. And, of course, at that point in his life, he was not too well. But he came anyway. And you were there, and we had the little band. You had the little band with Jackie Byard.
Oh, yeah.
Rocky
yeah.
was the drummer.
Right.
I forget who the bass player was. Can't remember.
Probably J.J. Wiggins, Jr.
Maybe. But anyway, as sick as he was, he got out there. And I remember you were giving me directions. You said, come on, Marion, you get out there. Or Jackie played first with the small group, and you were sort of taking care of the gig. And then when they were through doing a couple of numbers, Duke came out and played. And, I mean, I think that was the thrill of my life to have him do that for these kids.
Oh, he got a great deal of enjoyment out of it himself because, you know, communication with kids, I think, is one of the most difficult activities that's possible. And it's hard for a lot of people to find out what the procedure is or what the requirements are. It's very simple. It's honesty. You can't kid kids.
You can't kid kids? No, that's absolutely true. Well, because these were grade school. Well, some of them were junior high. And I mean, that tune, Sea Jam Blues, was just made for kids that didn't know that much about music. I mean, all they have to play is... It's such a wonderful tune. And
Bob was great in figuring out how to be ignorant. Because and successfully so. In other words, to be uninhibited. You know, he's got several songs he did that, like that through his career. Metronome, All Out.
What? How to be ignorant? Is that what you
No, it's that's what I call ignorant music. one of his foremost statements to me after I had gone to Juilliard, and at a later date studied the Schillinger system in NYU. I was playing and writing much better music before I went to school. So then I had to find a couple of people like Andy Gibson and learn how to be ignorant again.
Oh, that's really funny. But I mean, that was a great time. But and of course, by that time, you were you had been for a while the manager of the band, but you were the manager of the band for a long time before weren't you?
That was, the way I became the band manager was having an apprenticeship with Cootie Williams after he left Ellington. And he said, you know arithmetic, so you're going to be the manager. And as a result, that meant I could do payrolls and all. And finally, in the years to come, after Al Selly lost his eyesight, they recalled my experience with Cootie, because Cootie was back with the band now. And he says, I know the right manager. And he named me, and that's how I got the gig back. And I never knew a job that I disliked as much as that job of being a road manager. Frank Holzfein was invited to take the job.
The owner of the Blue Note.
Yeah. Yes. He said, no, Duke. He said, I'd rather be your friend. And that was great logic. I never understood it at first. But you had to be a detective. You had to insist upon discipline without any endorsement from the boss. You had to know exactly where the various people were and be sure they got to the bus on time. And it was just, a nightmare, actually. So finally I was released and became a trumpet player again.
Well, then who became the band manager after that?
I'd find some patsy and get him to do whatever work was necessary or a statement to be made and got away from it. But that was really, and it plagued me, because years after that, almost every time I saw Charlie Parker, he said, I need a band manager. So I said, Charlie, anything but being the manager. And I really wanted and loved Charlie Parker. I'd like to hang with him all the time, but that would have been a bit much.
Well, when I think of some of the things that you described in your book about, not only getting the guys to the bus, but the conditions some of them would be in, and the thing that always broke me up was them getting up on the bandstand. That there were certain guys that wanted to be last up on the stand.
Oh yeah, Jimmy Hamilton and Johnny Hodges.
Johnny Hodges and who?
Jimmy Hamilton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the logic in the old days was if you got it on the bandstand early, you were worried about being fired and make sure you didn't get the boss angry. And they wanted everybody to know they were so great that they couldn't get fired.
Oh, that's fantastic. I remember also he would be up on the bandstand first and he'd be noodling on the piano and everybody would come sort of trickling up. Slow degrees.
Well, that feud between Johnny Hodges and Jimmy Hamilton helped to create an additional tune, Kind of Dukish, which was really the vamp to Rockin' and Rhythm. And they had to play it, just do anything to play tricks while they got these two in place. Because it left a big hole in the saxophone section, two saxophones out.
Of course, Rockin' I never knew things like that. I mean, I know all these different tunes were written for different reasons, but I didn't know about that one. Oh, gee, yeah. I don't know if I can play the whole thing all through.
Well, don't play it all through. I just want the folks to recognize what part of it that we're talking about.
I know, yeah.
Because they've heard it through years.
Okay.
The whole thing developed itself. It's like a lot of songs that Ellington played were never written, like Perdido and Caravan. I mean, by the time they got through, they made little licks up and stuff like that. Because in the Cotton Club in the earlier days, they'd bring an act there. And it was always a very great situation for both parties. You'd have an act that didn't have any music. And then you had musicians in the band that couldn't have read it if the music had been. So they'd take a guy like Rubber Legs Williams and say, okay, how about this? And wouldn't you like to do that? And Snake Hips Tucker and the rest. And they would just act, just think of anything, play anything, as long as it fit the act, and that was it. They had a new number, and the band played it, and that was it.
Well, who would start a thing like that? Would Duke start on the piano?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because, I mean, just like I said in the book, he was a con man, you know. He was really in the wrong industry. He should have been the man who ballyhooed the circus or something.
Well, he may even have done that in his time. But I'm just trying to think of some other thing. Like, well, Caravan, how did that come about? Was that something?
Well, Tizo did the melody, and he said, he used to hear those unusual melodies because in Puerto Rico, where he studied, they were very poor and they couldn't afford too much music. So in order to make them get more practice and get varied compositions, they turned the music upside down. you get that modal sound that comes from most of the things Tizo's involved in.
I think they're doing that to the music nowadays.
So anyhow, they start off and then somebody would put something behind it.
Just start.
That's true.
I mean, like they'd fill in like the middle parts and everybody knew what note to play pretty much, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think there was even a matter of knowledge. It was just a reaction, you know, and they would feel it, and then suddenly they'd play whatever it was.
Well, I don't know. Thinking about it, I just feel a tune coming on. I'd just love to play a tune. All these tunes go floating through my head. If I did Prelude to a Kiss, what would that bring back for you in terms of anecdotes or something?
Oh, I don't know. I know it wasn't because I was kissing anybody.
Well, maybe I should find another tune in a sentimental mood.
Prelude is lovely. I know one thing about Prelude to a Kiss. I think more people have gotten in trouble playing that song, both from playing it and also from singing it, because it sneaks up on you and the range is not really cognizant. I mean, you know, it's pretty wide in its range.
It sure is.
And it's one of the things that that Ellington used, which was much different as the years went through, because of the inversions that he used in composing the song. A lot of stuff is just like ground bass, you know, if you played blues or something like that, the note on the bottom is the name of the chord, but not in Prelude to a Kiss. Be My Guest.
To hear the full Piano Jazz broadcast, tune in next week to your NPR station. Log on to pianojazz.npr.org to find a station in your area. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. Support for Piano Jazz comes from Save America's Treasures, a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Parks Service, Department of the Interior, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.